Very good meeting this past week, don't you think? Wasn't it encouraging to see all of the visitors? I think it was pretty conspicuous that we had a whole bunch of young people here on Monday and Tuesday night, and of course a lot of others as well, but the fact that so many college-age kids took the time to come and worship with us certainly was very encouraging. And I certainly appreciate all the efforts that some of you, perhaps all of you, made toward the meeting. Some of your efforts may not have been as obvious as others. It is clear that many of you made an effort to get people to come. Some of you probably were disappointed that the folks that you asked did not make it, but clearly we did have some visitors here from the community. And some seeds were planted, and hopefully some good will come from that. But in so many ways, so many of you made a contribution toward the meeting. And if nothing else, in your attendance and your participation in the worship and in your close attention to the lessons, that within itself is certainly very meaningful. Here's the title of this morning's lesson. Jesus wept, and so did Paul. Just think about that for just a moment. Where do you think we're going with this lesson? Jesus wept, and so did Paul. If you're playing Bible trivia, and the question is, what is the shortest verse in the Bible? Do you know the answer? I remember playing a lot of Bible trivia when I was a youngster, and I always loved when I got this one because I was ready with it. John 11:35. Very quickly. I mean, I'd get that out of my mouth. John 11:35. And that's where the statement is made. The very simple statement. Jesus wept. And of course, the occasion was at the death of Lazarus. But there were other times that Jesus wept. Let me give you a couple of examples of that. In Luke chapter 19, in verse 41, it says, "Now as he drew near, he saw the city," speaking of Jerusalem, "and wept over it." Of course, if you're familiar with the context of that passage, you know that he went on to say, "If you had only known the things that would make for your peace." And then, of course, he then went on to warn them about their impending destruction. He was weeping over this city because of its sinfulness and for the fact that they were about to be punished for their sin not too many years from the time that he spoke these words. Also in Hebrews chapter 5 and verse 7, again referring to Jesus here, says, "Who in the days of his flesh, when he had offered up prayers and supplications with vehement cries and tears to him, who was able to save him from death and was heard because of his godly fear." And I believe that's referring specifically to his hour of sorrow there in the Garden of Gethsemane. We know from reading the passages that describe the situation there in Gethsemane that he was very sorrowful. Here it describes him as uttering vehement cries and tears to the Lord. So we know, of course, that Jesus was very emotional at that time. It's no wonder that Jesus is described in Isaiah 53 in verse 3 as a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. And certainly if you read his entire life story as it's recorded in the Gospels, you can see that that's the case. But we also know that Jesus showed some other emotions. Not just sorrow, but he showed some other emotions as well. In Mark chapter 3 and verse 5, for example, when he had healed the man with a withered hand on the Sabbath and was criticized for doing so, it says there in Mark 3 and verse 5, "And when he had looked around at them with anger, being grieved with the hardness of their hearts." So not only was he sorrowful for the way they responded to this, he was also angry. He experienced that emotion as well. We also know that Jesus was very angry. It's very apparent that he was angry when he drove the money changers out of the temple. And remember, he did that on two separate occasions. He did it early in his ministry, and he did it during that last week there in Jerusalem before his death. I don't think he was saying in his sweetest voice, "Get out of here. Do not make the Father's house a house of merchandise." I don't think he was saying it in his sweet voice. He was angry. Jesus experienced sorrow, but he also experienced anger. Luke chapter 7 in verse 13 speaks of another emotion that Jesus experienced. It says, "When the Lord saw her, he had compassion on her and said, 'Do not weep.'" Of course, this is referring to the widow there from the city of Nain who had just lost her only son. Her only son had just died. So she's without a husband. Now she's without her only son. It says that Jesus had compassion on her. In Luke chapter 10 and verse 21, after the 70 that Jesus had sent out on a preaching journey had come back and given their report, it says, "In that hour, Jesus rejoiced in the Spirit and said, 'I thank you, Father, Lord of heaven and earth.'" And so you actually see two different emotions expressed in this passage, don't you? Joy and gratitude. And so we see sorrow on the part of Jesus. We see anger, we see compassion, we see joy, we see gratitude. Is it fair to say that Jesus is an emotional person? Is that fair to say? Most certainly he is. And of course, we could read other passages. Jesus expressed and experienced a wide range of emotions. This is just kind of like the tip of the iceberg right here. This is just to give us a sample of some of the different emotions that he experienced. Now, you remember the second part of the title, though, to the lesson? It said, Jesus wept, and so did Paul. And so let's look, first of all, at some occasions when Paul wept as well. In Acts chapter 20 and verse 19, when he's speaking to the elders from the church at Ephesus, he talks about his time spent with them and how he conducted himself while he was there in Ephesus. He says, "Serving the Lord with all humility, with many tears and trials, which happened to me by the plotting of the Jews." Now, if I understand Paul as well as I think that I do, I don't think the tears were just simply because he was feeling sorry for himself. If I know him like I think I know him, I believe the tears were probably more for sorrow over them and the fact that they were rejecting the gospel and persecuting him more than they were for himself. Perhaps some of that was involved as well. But you see the tears that he shed. A little bit later in that same chapter, still talking to these same elders, he says, "Therefore watch and remember that for 3 years I did not cease to warn everyone day and night with tears." And so there were times in his teaching during those 3 years, there were times when he was warning those brethren that he would be brought to tears. And that shouldn't surprise us. We see that Jesus was a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief, and really the same was true with Paul. And it's obvious that Paul had a strong feeling toward these people there in Ephesus. But what's interesting is you get down later in the passage, you can see that they reciprocated those feelings. Remember when he got ready to leave those elders? You remember the scene? It says there in Acts chapter 20 and verse 37 that they all wept freely and fell on Paul's neck and kissed him. It was a very, very emotional scene when he departed from these brethren in Ephesus. In 2 Corinthians 2 and verse 4, explaining his reason for writing to the brethren and his state while writing to these brethren, he says, "For out of much affliction and anguish of heart I wrote to you with many tears, not that you should be grieved, but that you might know the love which I have so abundantly for you." In Philippians 3 and verse 18, very similar passage, Since for many walk, of whom I have told you often, and now tell you even weeping, that they are the enemies of the cross of Christ. When he thought about those who were opposed to the cross of Christ and all the damage that they were doing and the brethren that they had become a stumbling block to, it caused him to weep. Now, I don't have this one up on the screen, but I might add to these another passage in Romans chapter 9. You remember the way Paul expressed his feelings toward his fellow Jews who were still unbelieving? He said there in Romans chapter 9 and verse 2 that I have great sorrow and continual grief in my heart. And then he went on in the very next verse to say, I could wish that I myself were accursed from Christ for these my brethren. If it would mean their salvation. That's how deeply concerned he was for his unbelieving Jews. Continual sorrow and grief in his heart. And so he had a tremendous depth of concern for his brethren. He had a tremendous depth of concern for the lost. And sometimes that poured out in tears. And of course, sorrow was not the only emotion that Paul experienced. Just like we noticed with Jesus, he experienced other emotions too. And we're not going to go through and cite a bunch of different passages. You can read in the book of Acts. What's said about Paul there? Look in his epistles. You'll see a wide range of emotions that are expressed there. Emotions like joy and gratitude, fear, compassion, even indignation. There in 2 Corinthians 11 and verse 29, Paul asks a rhetorical question. He says, who is made to fall and I do not burn with indignation? Boy, that's strong. When I hear of somebody who's been made to fall among my brethren, somebody that has led them astray, I am burning with indignation. I'm angry about it. I'm fired up about that. And so, again, it's clear. Jesus expressed a wide range of emotions. Paul did as well. And, of course, we've kind of limited our discussion to Jesus and to Paul, but look through the New Testament and you'll see that other Christians experienced a wide range of emotions too. And it started when? It started with their conversion to Christ. Remember the Ethiopian eunuch in Acts chapter 8? After he had been baptized, it says he went on his way rejoicing. You see the Philippian jailer, he and his household rejoicing after they had been converted to the Lord. And then you read about all of these Christians after that point, you see a lot of joy continue, but you see a lot of other emotions as well. Now, why have we done all of this? Why have we pointed out all of these things about Paul? Well, what we want to do, and about Jesus, what we want to do in the rest of the lesson is we want to make some observations and issue some warnings on this subject of emotions. We want to issue these observations and warnings based on what we've already seen, but we also want to bring in some other passages in the New Testament as well. And here's the first observation we want to make. Don't try to stifle genuine emotion. And don't be ashamed of it. And that's really one of the points that stands out to me when I read all of those passages that we just cited. It is possible that we can spend so much time mourning about emotionalism that we can almost strip people of emotion. We can almost make people ashamed of it. We can turn each other kind of into robots. And we ought not to be robots. The truth produces a lot of different emotions. And don't be ashamed. You know, sometimes you have to break script. Somebody comes forward confessing wrong, or somebody comes forward to be baptized into Christ. There's not a canned speech that needs to be delivered every time. If you're very emotional about that, express it. Don't be ashamed of it. There may be times you're making announcements and then there's people that you want to express a genuine appreciation for, and it's just something that you've been thinking about for a long time. You just feel with gratitude. Don't be afraid to express that. There's no reason for us to be robots. There's no reason for us to, you know, make it as stiff and always just as formal as we possibly can. We can go too far in the other direction, is what we're saying. Don't be afraid to show genuine emotion. Don't be ashamed of it. Now, on the flip side, don't ever fake it. Don't ever fake it. First of all, God will know for sure if you're faking it. You're not going to get by with it as far as He's concerned. And you know what? After a while, your brethren will begin to figure that out too. Now, why do sometimes people fake emotion? Well, there can be a number of reasons, but sometimes people fake some sort of emotion in order to draw a response. You know, we're not getting the response that we need from someone or from a group of people, and so we're going to really fake some emotions. We're going to dramatize this thing to the point, and that'll elicit the response that we're looking for. Wrong approach. You know what you ought to do to draw the response that you're looking for? And again, we're talking about a spiritual response here, a response of conviction. You know what you need to do? You need to do the same thing that preachers throughout the Bible did. And that is, you need to reason with people. You need to teach them. You need to produce conviction in their heart. When you reason with people and you teach them the truth, and they become thoroughly grounded in the truth, and they become convicted of the truth, the emotions then will be experienced. They will be the byproduct then of that conviction and of that truth that is in their heart. So don't ever, ever try to fake emotion. Here's another observation. Don't judge people to be unemotional based merely on the fact that they show very few outward displays of emotion. And this is not just some hypothetical point that I'm making here. I've heard this criticism administered by Christians. I've heard other Christians recently talking about other Christians, saying that they just don't see any emotion on their part. And again, I think all in the world that is they're not seeing enough outward display of it. You can't judge it simply by that. You know, there are other ways to judge the depth of one's spirituality than just by burst of emotion. In fact, there are better ways to judge the depth of one's spirituality than by these outbursts. You know what the best way is? The best way to judge the depth of one's spirituality? By their actions from day to day on a consistent basis. How do you judge that someone is deeply concerned about their brethren, for example? Well, they're constantly doing for their brethren, day by day by day. How do you judge the depth of one's concern for the lost? That he's always talking about how much he loves the lost? And every now and then a tear might come to his eye when he's talking about the lost. Is that the only way you judge? It is possible for someone to shed a tear about the lost and still not do a whole lot. The depth of one's concern is judged by how much he goes out and does something. Okay? So, let's be very, very careful. Well, for example, in the worship service this morning, do you know how emotional any one person in the audience got today? You think Lamar got emotional today? I don't know. I can't tell. I mean, I looked over there one time. I didn't see him crying. I didn't see him pumping his fist up in the air. But I suspect, knowing Lamar like I do, that there were times during the service today he felt gratitude. There were times he probably felt some joy. In looking at the different songs, there might have been any number of different emotions that he experienced based on the words that were expressed in these songs. So, again, it's not just about outward displays. Activity, consistent, day-by-day activity, is really the best way to judge. Here's another observation, or really a warning about emotions. And that is, emotions can be pretty fickle. In other words, you can feel one way one moment and entirely different the next. There can be wild swings of emotion, and sometimes, even when the situation hasn't changed a whole lot. Let me give you a couple of examples. Remember Acts 14? The people of Lystra? You remember how they first received Paul and Barnabas? Thought they were gods, were ready to sacrifice to them, and then just a short time later, what were they doing? Participating in the stoning of Paul. Okay? You see the wild swing there? Paul didn't change. Paul and Barnabas didn't do anything different. One minute they were ready to sacrifice to them, the next minute they were ready to kill them. That's the nature of it. That's what can happen. How about Galatians chapter 4? Let's turn there and read that passage. Galatians chapter 4. Beginning with verse 14, kind of similar to what we just talked about in reference to the people there in Lystra. You remember the situation with the churches of Galatia? They were beginning to turn away from the true gospel. He warned about that or talked to them about that in the very first chapter. But beginning in verse 14, in my trial which was in my flesh, you did not despise or reject, but you received me as an angel of God, even as Christ Jesus. What then was the blessing you enjoyed? For I bear you witness that if possible, you would have plucked out your own eyes and given them to me. That's how emotionally attached they had become to Paul. Then verse 16. Have I therefore become your enemy because I tell you the truth? They didn't hold Paul in such high esteem any longer. Others had come in, the Judaizing teachers mixing in the old law with what they were, you know, insisting that the Gentiles had to be circumcised and keep the law of Moses. And now all of a sudden Paul's not thought of nearly as highly as he was before. You see how fickle emotions can be, and perhaps you can look at your own life. And you've probably experienced that wild swing, and you really didn't have that much of an explanation for it. We're just pointing out a danger of making emotions the end-all, be-all. You need to understand that by their very nature, they can sometimes be very fickle. Here's another warning concerning emotions, and that is that they can sometimes be misplaced. That is, you can feel one way when you really should feel another. I'll give you an example from Acts chapter 7 in verse 41, which is a reference back to Mount Sinai and how they built the golden calf at that time and were worshiping it. In Acts chapter 7 and verse 41, and they made a calf in those days, offered sacrifices to the idol, and rejoiced in the works of their own hands. If you go back and read the actual account in Exodus, the rejoiced here is putting it lightly. I mean, they were having a big time. They were enjoying themselves over this. And really, isn't that what's going on a lot in religion today? Rejoicing over the work of their own hands. People have come up with something on their own, doing their own thing. It's not God's plan. It's something entirely different. And they're just having a big time with it. And then the question becomes, How can it be so bad when it feels so good? See? Everybody's having a good time over this. Everybody feels good about this. How can it be wrong when it feels so good? When I look at that reference in Acts 7:41 and think about the point that we're making here, it makes me think about the thing that's said about love in 1 Corinthians 13 and verse 6. Love does not rejoice in iniquity, but rejoices in the truth. These folks were rejoicing in iniquity. And to some degree, the church at Corinth was doing the same thing in regard to that man who had his father's wife. He says, you've become puffed up about it, and you really should be mourning. And also think about the passage there in James chapter 4. When James was addressing some of his worldly-minded brethren, he says, let your laughter be turned to mourning and your joy to gloom. You've got one emotion right now. It ought to be something entirely different. You ought not to be happy right now. You ought to be sad. So emotions can be completely misplaced. I think sometimes, as parents, we're guilty of this. You ever heard a parent rejoice in some activity of their child and some accomplishment of their child that they really have no business rejoicing in? Because it's really not something they should have been doing in the first place. It's not something their parents really ought to be proud of. It's in sharp contrast to what John wrote there in 3 John when he said, I have no greater joy than to see my children walking in the truth. That's when we ought to be really kicking up our heels. Sometimes we get all emotional about things our children are involved in, and it's not even according to the truth. Emotions can be entirely misplaced. Here's something else we need to say about emotion, and that is that some degree of control must be exercised over our emotions. We said earlier in the lesson, don't be afraid to show genuine emotion. Don't be afraid to, or don't try to stifle that. But there are times when emotions need to be brought under control, because if not, we could say or do the wrong thing. 1 Peter chapter 2. I'll give this as an example of what we're talking about here. 1 Peter 2. Beginning with verse 18. Servants, be submissive to your masters with all fear, not only to the good and gentle, but also to the harsh. For this is commendable if because of conscience toward God one endures grief, suffering wrongfully. For what credit is it if when you are beaten for your faults you take it patiently? But when you do good and suffer, if you take it patiently, this is commendable before God. All right, put yourself in the place of the servant who does nothing but good every hour of every day for his master, and yet he keeps getting beaten over and over and over. What do you think your emotions would be? Think you'd become angry? Think you'd be ready to rail at this man and to fight back and to get your revenge, to walk off the job? To... Says you got to keep on doing good, despite the way they're treating you. In other words, you've got to get those emotions under control. Ephesians chapter 4 says, be angry and sin not. Okay? There are times things are going to happen, and there's going to be an emotion that we're going to experience. I mean, it's going to come upon us all of a sudden. And if we're not careful, and if we don't exercise control at that point, in just a few moments, we're going to have said or done something that is going to be hard to get back. That's going to do a whole lot of damage. And so this idea of just, you know, giving our emotions just free rein and just whatever, that's not scriptural. We know better than that. Now, here's really a key question in all of this. How do we then avoid these missteps when it comes to emotions? We know that they can be very fickle. We know that they can be very misplaced. We know that they can sometimes get out of control. How do we avoid these missteps when it comes to emotions? Well, I don't want to oversimplify the answer, but really what it is a full understanding of the truth. To use the language used in the Epistle to the Colossians, the full assurance of understanding. That's what we're aiming for. In fact, let's turn now to Colossians, and I want to read a couple of passages there. Colossians chapter 1. Colossians chapter 1, beginning with verse 9. I want us to notice from this passage what the Lord is after first and foremost. For this reason we also, since the day we heard it, do not cease to pray for you and to ask that you may be filled with the knowledge of His will in all wisdom and spiritual understanding, that you may walk worthy of the Lord, fully pleasing Him, being fruitful in every good work and increasing in the knowledge of God, strengthened with all might according to His glorious power for all patience and long-suffering with joy, giving thanks to the Father who has qualified us to be partakers of the inheritance of the saints in the light. In many ways, this passage is very similar to one in Ephesians chapter 4, where the Lord discusses the aims for every Christian, the goals that are out there for every Christian, and even why He has organized the local church in the way that He has. What is it that He wants to produce in every Christian? Well, the primary goals expressed here in Colossians 1 and also in Ephesians 4 is that we come to an understanding of the truth. That we have the kind of conviction to where we're not tossed to and fro. And guess what? When we come to that full assurance of understanding and when we have that kind of conviction, there will be plenty of different emotions that are produced by that. There are many emotional byproducts to the truth. I'm not going to stand up here and say Christianity is not an emotional religion. It is. It is. But only when we understand it as we ought to. When we come to that full assurance of understanding. Look in chapter 2, beginning with verse 1. For I want you to know what a great conflict I have for you and those in Laodicea, and for as many as have not seen my face in the flesh, that their hearts may be encouraged, being knit together in love, and attaining to all riches of the full assurance of understanding, to the knowledge of the mystery of God, both of the Father and of Christ, in whom are hidden all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge. The truth trumps emotions. Okay? That's one of the points that we're trying to get across here. And several things as far as the relationship between truth and emotion. First of all, as we've tried to say several times already, the truth will produce genuine, heartfelt emotions. Okay? But not only that, the truth will regulate our emotions. We talked about how our emotions can sometimes be very fickle, how they can be misplaced, how they can get out of control. Guess what's going to keep them from being so fickle and from being so misplaced and from getting out of control? What is it that's going to regulate those emotions? The truth. But then also, the truth will root out certain emotions which we really ought not to experience. Emotions that can come very easily to us, but which we must fight against. And you know the primary one I'm thinking about? self-pity. It comes very easily, doesn't it? It comes very easily. But the truth will root that out. Read through Paul's epistles. You see any self-pity there? Read through the life of Jesus. See any self-pity there? Read Facebook. You see any self-pity there? All the time. It's everywhere. Including a lot of my brethren, my brothers and sisters in Christ. Lots and lots of self-pity. The truth will root that out. And so it produces genuine emotions. It regulates our emotions. And it will root out the emotions which we ought not to have, that we ought to fight against. Now, there's one other point I want to make. And again, this is not something hypothetical. This is a real danger I believe we face today. Don't ever try to change God's plan for any reason, including for the reason to generate more emotion. And in particular, I'm talking right now about changing His plan of worship. There are a number of brethren now who are arguing for changes in our worship. Now, there's at least a half-hearted effort sometimes to show some authority for that. Now, they're unable to do so, but there's some half-hearted effort to show the authority for it. But the driving engine behind it is, we're not getting enough out of our services now. And something has to be done so that we can get more out of our services. Now, if we're not getting very much out of our services, whose fault is it? It's yours. And it's mine. The plan that is in place for our worship is fully capable of generating plenty of emotions. In fact, you may experience any number of different emotions when gathered for worship. Is it possible for you to experience fear? Sure. Upon hearing a sermon? Felix did. Felix trembled when Paul reasoned about righteousness, self-control, and the judgment to come. Is it possible to experience joy? Sure it is. Or gratitude, or sorrow, or compassion, or any number of other different emotions. If you never experience any of these emotions, and I'm not talking about having some outburst. If you never experience any of these emotions, there probably is a problem with your understanding. The deeper our understanding, the deeper our emotions will be. But nobody else may know that. Nobody else may know that. But again, let's be careful about, well, let's just don't even consider the notion of changing God's plan in any way. It's the truth. We must follow it. And really, if your heart is fully engaged in all that the Lord prescribes for us to do on the Lord's day, it is very likely that you will experience these different emotions at some time or another. Go ahead and get out your song, but we'll sing the song of encouragement here in just a moment. One of the emotions that you may experience during a worship period, it may come as a result of the sermon. It may come as a result of a song that you've heard. It may come as a result of the invitation song. But one of the emotions that you may experience is sorrow. And I'm talking in particular about sorrow over your sins. Remember the woman in Luke chapter 7? She wiped the feet of Jesus with her hair. You remember what she used for ointment? What did she moisten His feet with? Her tears. She was crying. She was crying hard. And it had everything to do with her sins. Again, someone can be sorrowful for their sins. You may not see it outwardly. There may not be any tears shed. But that may be the very way that you're feeling now. You may be sorrowful over the fact that you have not yet obeyed the gospel, or you have not yet returned to the Lord as an erring Christian. But the thing about it is, remember we mentioned the eunuch earlier, how he went on his way rejoicing? You can do the same this morning. You can go on your way rejoicing, having made your life right with God. If we can help you in any way, come as we stand and sing.